Healthy Alternatives. Both research and real-life experiences are making it clear every day that our traditional medical system and practices need to be rethought, revised, and recharged in light of a more holistic approach to health. Dr. Jerry V. Teplitz, host of Healthy Alternatives, has been a pioneer for 36 years in stress management and optimum health. With a Ph.D. in holistic health sciences, a law degree, and as the author of 8 books, all focused on health, stress management, and performance, Dr. Teplitz is uniquely qualified to help us explore and incorporate healthy alternatives into our daily lives. He is a professional speaker and has shared his wisdom with over 1 million people. Join him to reach your highest level of health and wellness. Now, here's Dr. Teplitz.
Welcome to Healthy Alternatives. I'm Dr. Jerry Teplitz. What Healthy Alternatives is about, we all want to live longer, enjoy life even more, and that's what I attempt to bring you on each of the Healthy Alternative shows. My guest I'm going to be interviewing a little later on is Dr. Charles Krebs. Dr. Krebs has a very different background in that he was a former associate professor of biology at St. Mary's College of Maryland, a research scientist at the Queenscliff Marine Science Laboratory, and chief analytical chemist and head of the EPA Water Quality Laboratory for Victoria in Australia. Now, the interesting thing is Dr. Krebs had an accident and became paralyzed. That forced him into looking at all kinds of different approaches that you can use that were non-traditional, and that had him developing a whole system that not only helped him, but has helped many, many others. He's written 2 books, A Revolutionary Way of Thinking and Nutrition for the Brain. And we're going to be talking to Dr. Krebs in just a few minutes. Every week, I like to begin the show by talking about an issue, area, concern that you should know about because it can have a real impact on you. What I want to talk about is from a book called Unaccountable, What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Health Care. The people who wrote this book did some research and they looked at the safety culture in hospitals. They asked in 60 hospitals, doctors, nurses, other employees, questions that included, do you feel comfortable speaking up when you have a safety concern? And does the teamwork here promote doing what's right for the patient? The interesting thing is about 1/3 of the hospitals, most of the employees believe that teamwork was bad. Hospitals began to tell the researchers that their bad teamwork correlated with the infection rates and negative patient outcomes. And even when the doctors knew what needed to be done to make things better, they felt disempowered because of what they perceived to be a growing divide between hospital management and frontline providers. Most of the data, if there is any out there, has been hidden from the public on what's going on in hospitals. But there was a study that was done where they had hospitals in New York were required to release results on mortality rates. And what they found is one of the hospitals, Erie County Medical Center, was actually the state's worst performing hospital. They had an overall mortality rate higher than that of soldiers who had been wounded in Iraq. Now, within 3 years of making this rate public, it was cut from 18% to 7%. And then since then, it has fallen to 1.7%. This is really an example where transparency really does work so that people can survive their hospital experience. If you want to know more about me, Dr. Jerry Teplitz, you can find out more about me at teplitz.com, T-E-P-L-I-T-Z.com, and you can also follow me on Twitter and Facebook. I have a free monthly e-newsletter called Teplitz Report. It comes out once a month and it has health, nutrition, wellness items in it that you can really use in your life. You can sign up for it by going to teplitz.com and you'll see the About Home button. You can click there. Every week, I also like to talk to you about a healthy breakthrough. It's the newest information, latest breakthroughs that can really assist you in your life. What I want to talk about, marijuana, or one of the elements in marijuana, it's called cannabidiol, CBD. Some researchers have been looking at this and found it's non-toxic, non-psychoactive chemical, but it's within the marijuana plant. The exciting part of this research is they found that this compound can stop metastasis in many kinds of aggressive cancers, potentially altering the fatality of the cancer. So there have already been laboratory and animal testing supporting this finding, and so the researchers are now waiting for permission to do clinical trials in humans. See, what's taking place is there is a gene that's called ID1, and this is a gene that causes metastasis to take place. What the CBD does is it essentially turns off the ID1 gene, which means it stops the cells from spreading and it returns them to normal. So we're looking at something that's very exciting. And by the way, because it comes from the marijuana plant doesn't mean that you can take it and get high. You can't. But you do need it in concentrated formats, because either injections or they're also testing pills, because you can never get enough of this CBD to have an impact on the cancer. Before I bring on my guest, Dr. Charles Krebs, I'd like to talk to you about a book I've got called Managing Your Stress in Difficult Times. If you're under stress nowadays, and lots of us are, this is a book that is full of tools, techniques, methods you can use to handle the stresses you experience. It's powerful book. It comes with a 60-day money-back guarantee. If you purchase it on my website at teplitz.com and click on the products button. You can also find it on amazon.com. My guest today is Charles Krebs. Charles has 15 years of teaching and research experience. He's a former associate professor of biology at St. Mary's College of Maryland, a research scientist at the Queenscliff Marine Science Laboratory, and chief analytical chemist and head of the EPA Water Quality Laboratory for the state of Victoria in Australia. He's published scientific papers and two books. The books are A Revolutionary Way of Thinking and Nutrition for the Brain. And in working with clinical psychologists, speech pathologists, neurologists, he's developed what he calls Learning Enhanced Acupressure Program, which is aimed at really helping correct people's learning problems. And he is now at the Lydian Center for Innovative Medicine, Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Charles, welcome to Healthy Alternatives.
Well, welcome. Thank you for having me on, Jerry.
So let's start with, because I know you had a very severe accident a number of years ago that really is what pushed you into looking alternatively. Can you tell our listeners, my listeners, about that?
I'll give the short story. And that was, I was a research scientist at the time and a marine scientist and basically setting up a marine pollution monitoring program for the state of Victoria in Australia. And I'd moved there to do that from St. Mary's College. And I loved it, was doing great. And then as one of these days that just changes your life, I was on my rec leave. That's my recreation leave. And we were, of course, what does a marine scientist do but go scuba diving? And we were off Wilson's Promontory, an incredible, huge granitic peninsula that juts into Bass Strait, the southernmost tip of the Australian continent. And there's some phenomenal diving off there. And I was there with a couple of professional divers that ran a dive boat, and my friends Robbie and Kathy. And So we were diving all week, and we were working up to make a deep dive at the end of the week to look at, see if we could find the Konawara, which is a ship that went down in the 1880s, and they thought they'd seen on a previous dive. But that was at the limits of air diving, about 200 feet, 180 to 200 feet of water. And so what you do is you dive progressively deeper every day, so you release cavitation points that might form bubbles, you know, when you dive deeper, to prevent nitrogen narcosis and the bends. And everything was going perfectly. We made a perfect dive, and I came up from the dive, and then I had a little joint bend. I had a little bit of nitrogen bubble that had formed in my right elbow, and so therefore we went to wet recompression. We had extra tanks, just put tanks on, went down, breathed for another 45 minutes at 30 feet of water, came up, felt good, you know, went and sat down. Next thing you know, I started developing symptoms of what's called a type 2 cerebrospinal bend. So when the nitrogen bubbles form inside your joints, clearly they then expand, and when you try to extend your joints, you compress the bubble, and that hurts. And so what you do is bend your arms and legs to reduce the pain, which is where it got the name the bends. And well, joint pains are painful. They're trivial in the sense that in 5 to 7 days, they'll go away all by themselves. You absorb all the nitrogen, you'll be back to being fine. But the other type of bend is a cerebrospinal bend, where the nitrogen bubbles form inside your brain, inside your spinal column. And there, they're inside a bony box. So as the bubble gets bigger, all it can do is crush the brain tissue around it, or the spinal cord around it. And worse than that is it blocks blood flow. And nervous tissue doesn't live very long without oxygen. And so I ended up having a type 2 cerebrospinal bend. And then I still have the world's record for the longest, deepest decompression. I decompressed at 300 feet of pressure for 10 days off the coast of Australia on an oil platform, and a decompression chamber there. And I was lucky to come. I went into the chamber, a C5 quadriplegic, totally paralyzed my neck down, and came out 10 days later, a T9 paraplegic in a wheelchair. So, I mean, considering the alternatives, this was not a bad outcome. And so then I was in a rehab hospital, and clearly they were teaching me how to live in a wheelchair because they had no hope that I'd ever walk again. But I thought I'd give it a try. And so I did things that not a lot of other people could do, because I have some gifts. And one of those is a fairly photographic memory. And I had taught anatomy physiology for 9 years in university. So I can visualize the nerve pathway from my motor cortex to any specific muscle in my body, nerve by nerve by nerve by nerve. And then I'd done 15 years of martial arts, and I could break bricks and boards with my fist and my elbow. And you don't do that by punching a board, just get a bloody hand. You do that by moving chi. By moving the chi with your mind, and you deliver it with your hand, and it's the chi that breaks the board. It's hard if you don't have any concept of chi to understand that. In fact, at first when you're learning, it's hard to even grasp what they're talking about.
I've seen videos where they are showing the board starting to break even before the person hits them.
That because what's actually breaking the board is the chi that's only delivered by the hand. In fact, you only touch it for a fraction of a second. You hit it and back away, so you're actually not punching into it like a boxer. You're just hitting it and bouncing back. But in that, but you transfer the energy at that point, and that's what breaks the board. So I knew how to do that, and so I was lying in my bed thinking, okay, going to physiotherapist for an hour a day is not going to ever get me walking again. And I said, so what can I do? So I said, well, what I'm going to do is pick a muscle in my leg that doesn't work, and then I'm going to run this chi down that nerve pathway, nerve by nerve by nerve by nerve, down to the muscle. And I would just do that hour after hour after hour, and I happen to have a very strong will to do that. And
since you had nothing else to do.
I was so busy lying in bed, right? I could watch TV,
yeah.
But now there's a real wasteland. But moving chi was far more interesting than that. And so I just did this, and then once I made contact with the muscle, it didn't move, you know. But it was now my leg, not your leg, right? I'd actually contacted it, and I would just then keep doing that, and then I could not only contact, I could feel it actually kind of start to contract when I intended to contract. And then I asked the physiotherapist, what exercise do I need to do for this muscle? And then they told me what exercise for that. And then I would just practice that exercise hour after hour after hour, 8 hours a day, 7 days a week. And pretty soon it would begin to actually flex. I could actually, my foot wasn't moving yet, and my leg wasn't, but I could see it actually flexing. And then pretty soon I could start to move my leg just a tiny little bit, and more and more and more. And then when, then I could start to get my foot off the ground. And then once I could move my leg in that, activate that muscle easily, I went to another muscle. And first I put a half a kilo weight on my muscle, and it was right back on the floor. I couldn't move it. Then went through the same thing, running the cheese, sweating and shaking, trying to get it off the floor, get it to move again, 1 kilo, 2 kilos, 5 kilos, another muscle. I just did muscle after muscle until I could walk again, which was pretty amazing. It took me 8.5 months of doing this. And then when I was walking out of the hospital, the neurologist standing there just shaking his head saying, "You're one of the most neurologically damaged people in this ward." He said, "I have no idea how you're walking out of here." But of course, he didn't want to hear about energy either. That was the interesting thing. That's too much information, you know. And then I was walking, but with two canes, that first with two arm crutches, you know, I was really having a difficult time. And you know, it's not easy, you know. And so therefore I wanted to walk better. You know, and also I walked very much like a cerebral palsy person, where my foot would turn in. I couldn't lift my toes up very much, so I dragged my feet and trip and fall all the time. And I dragged my feet so badly I had steel plates on my shoes, and I wear those plates off once a month, right? And so then I said, okay, I've done what I can do. Western medicine did what I couldn't do, which they kept me alive when I should have died. The doctor thought I was going to die for sure in the decompression chamber. And so then I've done what I could do. I got walking. I want to walk better. I'm going to try alternative medicine. I mean, I had no idea about anything alternative. I was an analytical chemist at that point, and that was all woo woo wah wah stuff. Of course, if you ask me what I knew about it, practically nothing. So clearly my skepticism is based in ignorance, not in knowledge. And we often make that error. And so I started investigating different things and went through a whole range of different therapies, and starting with things like chiropractic and massage that were kind of based in things I could understand a little more, and then slowly drifted into more energetic things, and eventually even to Filipino faith healing, where they put their hands in the body and pull things out. And so I experienced a fairly wide range, and I had a friend that was the kind of guy that was, he was with the first healer when he came into town. And he was a guy I met at the ashram, was doing a lot of meditation, et cetera. And so he called me and said, "Charles, I just saw this doctor from New Zealand. He does this incredible stuff called kinesiology and acupressure, and I think it might help you." I said, "Well, that's good. That sounds interesting to you." And he said, "Oh," and he said, "I made an appointment for you at 2:00. Can you go?" So I could. So I went, and walked in with my cane and, you know, dragging my feet and arching my hips and laid down on the table. And then they did a bunch of things that, if nothing had happened, I would have just considered one of the weirder of all the weird things I tried. Because I'm lying there and I'm watching my arm go up and down, and they're touching points of my neck and my head, and I'm going, hey, my legs are the problem. I mean, I had no clue what the heck they were doing. Then they said an hour and a half later, okay, get up and walk. Well, much to my amazement, I now was walking. My whole neurology had been totally reorganized. That was more than 2.5 years after my injury, which by that time it's impossible for this to occur according to current neurophysiological theory. And so with that, I then wanted to know, how did this work? So that was Wednesday afternoon, and Friday evening was my first kinesiology course. And I've basically been involved with kinesiology and acupressure since that day. Even though I did go back to work and was head of the water quality lab, I was on the weekends doing kinesiology and trainings, and then I started working clinically. And then and
it made Charles, let me hold you for a second because I got to take a break. So before we continue, I'd like to remind you, you're listening to Healthy Alternatives, Dr. Jerry Templets on webtalkradio.net. And we'll be back with my guest, Charles Krebs, in just a moment.
What I want to talk to you about is a book I've done with Donna Fisher called Switched On Networking, Balance Your Brain for Networking Success. Donna is an authority on networking, both social media and also face-to-face. And in the book, in each chapter, she gives you techniques and approaches that you can use to be more effective in both social and face-to-face networking. And at the end of each chapter, I take you through this brain gym process to rewire your brain to switch you on for being more effective and successful. It's one of the first books, the other one, Switched on Selling, that I did with Dr. Tony Alessandro, that really lets you be successful right after you've read what Donna wrote. You can find that book on my website at teplitz.com. Click on the products button and you can get it there. Or you can go to Amazon and order it there as well.
So my guest today is Dr. Charles Krebs. Dr. Krebs has 15 years of teaching and research experience as a former associate professor of biology at St. Mary's College of Maryland. He was a research scientist at the Queenscliff Marine Science Laboratory. He was a chief analytical chemist and head of the EPA Water Quality Laboratory for the state of Victoria in Australia. He's published two books, A Revolutionary Way of Thinking and Nutrition for the Brain. And he developed, out of his own experience that we've just been talking about, a program that he calls LEAP, Learning Enhanced Acupuncture Program. So, Charles, we started talking about kinesiology towards the end. And so what kinds of kinesiologies are there out there from your standpoint? And just for our listeners to know, and if they've ever seen my program, I'm using kinesiology in it. But Charles uses it in a much very different way. So, Charles, can you talk about that?
Yes. When you say, what is kinesiology? It's one of these questions you go, oh, no. It's not a simple explanation. But in the simplest form, kinesiology, what it means is the study of movement. And of course, what causes movements is muscles. And its expression in Western science is called basically biomechanics and manual muscle testing. And so manual muscle testing was developed way back in the 1920 by a couple of brothers who were chiropractors that were dealing with the polio epidemic. And the Lovett brothers, Charles and Robert. And so Charles developed a scale that's still used today in physiotherapy to assess muscle function, but manually, just with your hand, not without any kind of instrumentation. And so they call this the plus five scale. And so in the plus five scale, you put a muscle in its position of mechanical advantage, where it should be strongest. And then you apply increasing pressure to the limb, so say it's the arm, the back of the wrist, and you're trying to push the arm down. And then you observe what happens. And there are several possibilities. One is you push on the wrist, it resists, and it keeps resisting, and you can go to a considerable pressure, and it still resists. If you push hard enough, eventually you will overpower it. But that's how strong the muscle is. In kinesiology, you're not measuring muscle strength, but integrity of the muscle circuit that's actually holding the arm in place. And so you only have to push till it locks, and they call that a plus five, because it locks until you overpower it, right? And so, and then what he found is that sometimes you push, and it doesn't quite lock, and it starts giving, but with considerable pressure in the direction of pressure. Then other times, you say hold, and it just goes down with moderate pressure. The person is amazed. And then it can be, you get it there, and the slightest pressure makes it move. That's a plus two. If you can hardly get it into the test position against gravity, that's a plus one. If you can't move it, that's flaccid paralysis. And this is the scale that's used in physiotherapy. It's a semi-quantitative scale because it's this judgment of lock and then how much pressure you have to push to move it. And so that technique, this manual muscle testing, was in academic and structural kinesiology and still taught in universities today. The field of kinesiology is about biomechanics. And now they use a lot of high-speed cinematography and EMG to assess exactly how the muscles are moving, etc. But kinesiology, in the sense that we're talking about it, is now moved into another paradigm, and we call it generally energetic kinesiology. Other types of kinesiology, and the first one developed was applied kinesiology, which is a chiropractic technique that's taught in many chiropractic colleges around the country and the world today.
Now, let me ask you a question, Charles. When a muscle is going weak, what's it signifying?
Well, this is unfortunate. Because we use the term in kinesiology, weak, and the muscle is strong, when neither of those terms is actually correct, okay? But it feels that way, and it looks that way. Because I push your arm, and it goes down. You can only assume it's weak, right? But it's actually inhibited. So if you have a 100-watt light bulb, and I turn the dimmer switch to 40 watts, it doesn't become a 40-watt light bulb. It's still a 100-watt light bulb with 40 watts of power. So you don't develop less muscle fibers than you have when I push and the arm goes down than when I push and the arm stays straight. What's happened is inhibition of that muscle circuit occurred, interference with the integrity of the neural flow that supports and holds the arm in place has occurred.
So it's kind of like having a gas engine where you cut down the fuel in half and it sputters and doesn't run well, doesn't get up to speed it needs to be because it doesn't have the energy to do that.
It's not that it doesn't have the potential strength, it can't activate that strength because of inhibition, usually from some other part of the nervous system. And that can be from an emotional part, that can be from an energetic connection to the nervous system, that can be from a physical stress reaction, a tendon or a ligament. So that one of the incredible things about muscle testing is it gives you access to the subconscious system because your arms and your muscles are not run consciously by you. They're run largely by the subconscious part of the nervous system that sets the basal muscle tone and sets what's called the load reflex, which is a spinal reflex that automatically allows you to compensate for load. So if I say hold and begin to press on your arm, you just say hold it there. But the load reflex takes care of everything else and just keeps increasing contraction to equal my pressure. You don't have to be involved at all. And so, in fact, that's why when you give people a subjective effort scale when they're being muscle tested and say, tell me how much effort you're making to resist the pressure, and the muscle circuit is inhibited, they'll say 7 to 9, 10, because they're trying as hard as they can. But when you actually look at the EMG and you actually measure the force applied, it's not that way. They're actually giving at a much lower pressure than if you then do something to balance that muscle, and now it's locked. Now they can withstand 3 times as much pressure, but to them it feels like you're hardly pushing. Because before, the subconscious circuits were turned off, and they were trying to do it consciously, separate pathways that go down.
Yeah, it's kind of the psychological response people had. My arm went down, you must have been pushing way hard. Then it stayed up.
If I'm making a 9 effort, you must be pushing hard. If I'm making a 3 effort, when are you going to push?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Now, what types of issues have you been able to work with through the LEAP program that you've developed?
Okay, so I basically went into general practice, but ended up, and I have really no idea how I ended up there working with children's learning problems. I guess
you woke up one day and there were kids there.
I guess I started with brain gym and educational kinesiology, and that works with learning problems, and then 3-in-1 brain program works. Instead, they work with dyslexia, and I just started, and I made a connection with this clinical psychologist, and she started sending people to me, and so I then found that when I did these techniques, I got some results, but these were basket cases. These were kids who other therapies had failed with. So, you know, the fact that brain gym and 3-in-1 didn't work for all of these children is not surprising. And they worked for about 60 or 70%. Children couldn't spell, couldn't read, now they could. But the other 30 or 40% were the ones that interested me. Why didn't it work for them? And so then I developed a whole model based on the function of how the brain must function to produce the results we see. Now, this model we know to be absolutely correct today, but in 1985, it was just a novel idea. And that is that the brain does almost nothing in any one place. It does everything in several different places at several different levels, and they have to be synchronized in time. So it's all about timing and coordination and connectivity, being connected to the right areas at the right time. If those connections get blocked, it's not that you have any brain damage, but you can't do that function because you can't turn on that function at the right time to support the next function. And that's the whole model underneath LEAP, is the fact that there's this connectivity issue, and that basically you have functional problems more often than organic problems. So many children that can't do things is not because they have organic damage. They used to think it was a lesion in the nervous system. It's a functional lesion. It's a disconnect of the synchrony and timing of the flows, and that just turns off the function. Okay, a simple one is if you can make pictures in your head, you can spell and learn your times tables. If you cannot make an image, you cannot learn to spell English correctly, at least not many words, and you have trouble learning your times tables because you need to make a picture and store your picture. How are you ever going to know there's a GH in right? We don't go ruck, you know, we don't say HG in there. There's no way to guess that. You know, how do you know there's no SH in patient? Well, if I say shent, you're going to think S-H-E-N-T, but no, T-I turns into S-H because it's from the old Anglo language, from the Anglo-Saxons. You know, so English is a very difficult, fairly non-phonetic language, and your spelling is a disaster if you cannot make pictures. And if you can't make pictures, you spell phonetically. You do the next best thing you can. The brain is always doing the next best thing it can. So a child spells phonetically, it's not because they're choosing not to learn to spell, it's because they can't make a picture. And they're doing the best they can already. That's how I ended up working with children learning problems and working out the problems that they have and ways of, you know, deciphering those problems on a whole system that's very sophisticated and very neurologically based. And it's based in what's called acupressure formatting, a concept developed by my mentor and myself, Richard Utt, who recently died last year in November, a very brilliant creative genius. And he came up with the concept that you could use mudras from yoga and acupoints from the Chinese acupuncture system and various combinations to ask quite sophisticated electromagnetic questions. And by frequency resonance pattern matching, he matched the mudras and finger modes, which he called an acupressure format, to specific brain functions and brain areas.
Charles, let me interrupt because I need to let people know how to, if they want to find out more about what you're talking about and pursue further, that they can go to the Lydian Center, LYDIANCenter.com. That's LydianCenter.com. And just so folks are aware, Charles is in the process of publishing the first textbook in this field. It'll be called The Fundamentals of Energetic Kinesiology, The Scientific Basis for Mind-Body Medicine, early next year. And you can contact him about the LEAP program, look at the website to learn more about what he's doing. Charles, thanks for being a guest today on Healthy Alternatives.
Thank you so much.
My guest next week is going to be Cecilia Koester. She goes by Cece. She's written two books, I Am the Child, Using Brain Gym with Children of Special Needs, and Movement-Based Learning for Children of All Abilities. Cece's background, she's been a special educator for over 30 years. She's worked both in and out of classrooms with children of all ages as a special ed teacher. And she has developed and worked with youth at risk in, get this now, in a bolt building school. We're going to talk about that and the courses she's developed and how she really helps children who have special needs. You're not going to want to miss this one. This is Dr. Jerry Teplitz, and you can find out more about me at teplitz.com and also on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today for Healthy Alternatives. For more information about Dr. Teplitz and his availability for speaking engagements, please click on the globe on the webtalkradio.net page in front of you or go to teplitz.com. You may also follow him on Facebook and Twitter by using the icons on the page. To find out more about his books, please click on any of the book covers you see. Eat well, rest well, take a breath, get some exercise, and we'll see you again right here next week for another edition of Healthy Alternatives.